Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Activist and commentator Don DeBart joins us from Austin, New York. Also joining us is journalist and author Daniel Lazar, also joining us from New York.
Okay, welcome to you both. So we are continuing this U.S. political violence theme in another episode of our program, and we deemed it to be that important, and I mentioned that in the last time we had that to both of you, because there were some revelations that were unprecedented in a sense, which is not associated in the mainstream outside of the U.S., perhaps, in terms of the depth of what this really means. So we had this attack, Daniel Lazar, first start with you, where you had Nancy Pelosi's husband, and I remember last time I made a mistake saying axe. Anyways, he was hit with a hammer. But the person who was looking for her, for the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, of which he said that he would injure her. Now the question comes about: is this just a lone incident of somebody, an American, acting out in this form and manner, which is obviously very violent?
Well, it's hard to say, but it's definitely, there's no question that tempers are rising, that tensions are increasing. There is a huge degree of polarization. People are very angry. And there's a great deal of, you know, talk of violence in the air. I mean, after all, on January 6, 2021, we had a mob invade Washington. Four or five people were killed. The mob, you know, members of the mob chanted, you know, "Where is Nancy? Where is Nancy?" Nancy Pelosi is a polarizing figure, and they engage in a great deal of destruction, and would likely have killed Nancy Pelosi if they'd gotten their hands on her. Probably is the same thing true for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others. So, you know, there's a real danger of violence because the machinery of government is breaking down, and as it breaks down, anger and frustration are increasing on all sides.
Don DeBart, isn't it a far cry, though, to have people, average Americans, in a matter of speaking, act out against politicians in a way? Well, I guess they mentioned the January 6th incident that happened there on Capitol Hill. For them to come out and want to kill their lawmakers, the U.S. politicians, how should one view that?
Well, let's look at it through the prism of the editorial pages of the New York Times in July 2018, where after Donald Trump met with Vladimir Putin to try to calm relations between the two countries, accused Trump of treason, and there were calls for him to be prosecuted for that, which, by the way, carries the death penalty. Let's start there. This is something that's been tracked. At Pew Research, for example, did a study in 2014 looking at the period from 1994 to 2014, and shows the entrenchment of this polarization, where large chunks of people on the left and right, quote unquote — these terms are really kind of meaningless right now — but the liberal and conservative are the terms they used in their study of the Democratic and Republican parties, respectively, how the number of Democrats that identified as liberal and Republicans that identified as conservatives had grown and hardened. The phenomenon really didn't begin in 1994. It began much earlier, of course. I remember the presidential election in 1980, for example. At the time, however, Democrats that identified as liberals were, among other things, anti-war, for example. One of the big fears of Reagan being elected in 1980 was that he would start a war with the Soviet Union. Here we are with someone who everyone calls in the political economy here a liberal, Joe Biden, is actually at war with Russia. You know, there's a lot of stuff to really sort of plod through here. There's just one last point, because I want clarity on this from the last conversation that we had. You know, Dan correctly referred to the fact that there is this other process where if there's a block, basically if the vote from each state at the joint session in January 6th is rejected, then the electors are chosen by a different mechanism than, you know, than, in other words, not voted on by the House members, but rather by people that are selected to do that job. As a matter of fact, you would never get there because you would first have votes in each of the two chambers on the challenges. And in each of those cases, those votes would be conducted in houses of Congress that had Democratic majorities on January 6, 2021. So the idea that somehow that insurrection was tied to a strategy for a coup d'etat, really, it just falls.
Okay, very well. Let's look at how long this has been going on, this term political violence, and, of course, the way that it has now really brought into the fore. Daniel Lazar. I mean, I went back as far as Abe Lincoln and the assassination that happened there, of which the person that did it said, I did what I thought was best. And then you had some periodicals that wrote that the Almighty God has ordered this event. And I mentioned that in terms of the periodicals, and I want to kind of compare that to, or make a note of what our guest there, Dan DeBar, said, that the New York Times, as a media, or a print media, is also lending a hand in the way that things become polarized by drawing that type of analysis. So are we looking as that as being something that has happened from way before and is just continued throughout the decades in the U.S.?
Well, not quite. I mean, first of all, the Lincoln was assassinated at the very end of a civil war which claimed 600,000 lives in a country at the time had about population about 24 million. So, you know, it was a bloody, bloody war, a huge war, and it culminated with the assassination of the leader of the Union forces. But after that, you know, things died down. There was, little of that sort of thing in Washington. But beginning in the 1960s, 1968, we saw a series of assassinations of Martin Luther King, Robert F. Kennedy. We saw the assassination of JFK in 63. But there's no doubt that passions have been heating up since the 1990s in a new way. The machinery of government is breaking down. We have had gridlock, an absolute deadlock in Congress for 30 years or so. Nothing can get done, and the less that gets done, the more frustrations rise on either side, and the more poisonous the atmosphere becomes.
Give us an example.
Well, you know, I mean, Newt Gingrich shut down the government on two different occasions. They impeached Bill Clinton for the crime of having a sexual, you know, engagement with one of with a White House aide. You know, each of these things, you know, sort of raised tempers to new levels, and there was no way of resolving these things because the angrier Republicans got, then the angrier Democrats got, and the more Congress stopped working. Uh-huh. The American government is based on this bizarre 18th century system of checks and balances. Basically, you have to have three or even four major institutions agree before anything can get done. That's the House, the Senate, the presidency, and the Supreme Court. And if each of those bodies has veto power. So what you found starting in the mid-90s was that that Congress and the presidency were vetoing one another constantly, and nothing happened, nothing got done. And the more of a stalemate you had, the angrier people got. And then the angrier they got, the more they dug their heels in.
I see.
You know, so the process is kind of self-fueling. And so tempers are now shooting upwards. We'll see what happens on the election on Tuesday. But I think that there's no doubt that the basic governmental functions in the U.S. are hanging in the balance. And American democracy, such as it is facing a major crisis. I mean, I rarely agree with Joe Biden about anything, but in this case, he is correct. The country is facing a major structural crisis.
Well, Don DeBar, since our guest star mentioned the midterms, looking at what the latest is on Joe Biden, who has obviously made a point to call upon the midterms and says, basically saying that, you know, this is something that is chipping away at the U.S. democracy, and that, you know, we can't, this shouldn't be happening. Why is the midterms going to be a reflection of this, in the sense that Joe Biden is painting that picture? Do you agree with him?
He has to paint that picture. First of all, look at Biden's own numbers. His numbers are the lowest for any sitting president since the day before Nixon resigned. That's a fact. And it's been that way for a good while now. He needs some sort of a distraction, or they're going to lose both houses, and he's may well be impeached. That's a fact also. Let's start with JFK, who was assassinated in November 1963, Malcolm X, who was assassinated in February 1965, Martin Luther King in April of 1968, Robert Kennedy in June of 1968. In each case, security forces inside the United States have at least been implicated if they have not been held responsible. Okay, if we look further, if we want to talk about political violence, hold the picture of Muammar Gaddafi after he was run with a spear or a gun with a knife on it, whatever you call it, bayonet. And the words, we came, they saw, he died. That's out of Hillary Clinton's mouth. I don't know how anyone can be sanctimonious about political violence when that's their team. Mm-hmm. This is something, again, and you asked, I missed it, because when we talk at the same time over these, you know, media, I can't hear when you, et cetera. You asked when H.R.A.P. Brown said that violence is as American as apple pie. And it was in 1967. So that's in the midst of the assassinations that I just ran. You know, we've seen political assassinations all the way up to an attempt today where they tried to kill Imran Khan. I'm guessing, if you find a dirty hand there, if the assassin, the attempted assassin, actually the assassin, because he did kill some other people, if they actually get him to trial, you may find out that the U.S. had a hand in that. Or look at Dugina, Dugin's daughter, that assassination. Certainly the U.S. or the U.K., the Ukrainians, et cetera, had a hand in that. This is political violence. This is real political violence. The attempts on Castro's life, you know, over the course of his time in office in Cuba, the attempts on Nicolas Maduro's life. I mean, this is U.S. policy. Sure. Why suddenly is a guy with horns a major threat to the U.S. democracy? I don't understand it. It's so absurd.
It is. And perhaps, now we're talking about the international arena and how the U.S. acts regarding that, but we're focusing on the U.S. here, so we have to go with that line for this program.
Malcolm X and Martin Luther King were domestic, and so were the two Kennedys.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Okay, to expand further on what Joe Biden said there, Daniel Lazar, which is what we're getting at here in some sense, or what I'm trying to get at from you, is the fact that political violence, according to U.S. Biden, U.S. President Joe Biden, he has said that it is undermining democracy. And he says, make no mistake, democracy is on the ballot for all of us. Do you agree with him?
I do, actually, yes. I mean, first of all, let me say that Don is correct. I mean, the U.S. has pursued violent policies abroad, for decades. And the assassination of Qasem Soleimani is just merely one example of U.S. policy. But the U.S. domestically has been kind of sort of a democracy all this period, and that matters too. People can speak their mind. I can write whatever I want to without worrying about police breaking down my door. And elections have been in general kind of decided in a fair and democratic manner. But that is breaking down dramatically. Joe Biden's speech was classic Joe Biden. Joe Biden doesn't admit that the American system as it presently exists is falling apart before our very eyes. So it isn't that the Republicans are doing this single-handedly. The Republicans are merely acting in response to what is plainly a systemic collapse. American political institutions are 235 years old. They have never been subject to a fundamental overhaul. The system is so old, so out of date, so unresponsive to the needs of modern society, it's not funny. And yet the system is so frozen that any kind of reform is impossible. You know, so we have an electoral college, a Senate which is unrepresentative. We have a Senate which is grossly unrepresentative. In the Senate, a majority of the population lives in just 10 states that are outvoted by the minority in the other 40. In the House, which is supposedly more Democratic, Republicans have enjoyed a 12 or 14% advantage since 2010. And now in the Supreme Court, Republicans have an unbreakable 6-3 majority. And they have, and that majority will persist for probably another decade. They've got a free hand to do whatever they want in American society, and the Democratic majority is powerless. So Americans live under a minority dictatorship, and that dictatorship is growing.
That's an interesting way of putting it. Americans living under a dictatorship. Well, Don DeBar, based on what Daniel Lazar there said, are we looking at a solution which is far-fetched, but then again, is something that could be put out there, and that is a reform, which I think Daniel Lazar said a reform is not even possible at this point, that you need an overhaul, I guess, of the whole system, so to speak. I mean, is that something that, but is that feasible? Is that realistic to look at it that way? And is that a cause of what we call, one of the outcomes being a political violence that has been part of U.S. politics and mainstream the mainstream average Joe on the streets there in the U.S.?
First, I'll agree in part with what Daniel just said about there being a systemic problem. Some evidence of that. I did a Google search for illegitimate president and qualified it before 12/31/2019. Hillary Clinton, here's a headline from the Independent in the UK. Hillary Clinton says Trump knows he's an illegitimate president. There's quotes and such. Former President Jimmy Carter says Trump is an illegitimate president. That's from Vox and NBC News. He lost the election, and he was put into office because the Russians interfered on his behalf. You know, this has been going on certainly since the 2016 election in depth. And let's not forget that there were mobs. There's no, you know, if what was outside the Capitol was a mob on January 6th, 2021, there were mobs on Inauguration Day in 2017 and lots of other occasions like during the Supreme Court appointments of Kavanaugh and others. This is something that I agree that there's a breakdown here. What I don't agree is that the solution is going to be somehow to redo the Constitution because it's 235 years old, because the first question that arises is who exactly is going to be in charge of that process. Because the real problem is that there is power that is much greater than the construct of that 235-year-old Constitution that sits on top of an empire around the world. And that is who would be handling the rewrite of the U.S. Constitution. And my guess is that the first target would be the Bill of Rights. And so, you know, we have some serious structural problems. The structural problems that we have is we have the largest military in the world. That's a bipartisan effort. You know, I don't know how you vote for democracy in the face of that when each party does nothing but increase the military budget and the reach of the military across the planet every time they're voted in. That's the problem that we have. I think our structural problems are a lot deeper than the old documents.
Sure. Well, the problems are so deep that there's not many, but there are some publications out there, Daniel Lazar, that have even mentioned. Daniel Lazar, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, great. That there's been talk about dividing the U.S. along the red and blue states. I mean, there's even been talks of that. So is that how deep this problem of political violence is, that it needs to go in that direction? I mean, we've heard about that. There's even been states that have said that they want to separate themselves from the U.S. But then overall, what about that approach? What's your thoughts on that?
I don't think that approach will work. I mean, that's a neo.
Not that it works, but what do you think about the fact that it went there?
I think it shows how polarized things are, and how the country is splitting up geographically as well as ideologically. There's no doubt about that. But listen, you have a 235-year-old system, and the idea that you can't touch this, that it is not subject to a democratic overhaul, is ridiculous. I mean, how much longer can people put up with this? Another 200 years? I mean, you know, would you want the same government in Iran that you had in the late 18th century? Does Russia want to go back to the age of Catherine the Great? Does France want to go back to the age of Louis the 16th? This, you know, the American government actually dates from the final years of Louis the 16th. And it has not changed fundamentally since. Uh-huh. This is a complete absurdity that people don't realize, even Americans don't realize, how profoundly conservative and backward their political system is.
Okay.
It's remarkable.
Well, the political violence has reached proportions that could be called epic, Don DeBar, if you agree or not. But there's also been coverage that some are saying may result in a civil war, that the political violence, because of a surge, a civil war is not so out of reach, and that it's exaggerated. Is it?
I think a civil war is being stoked, certainly. I don't think that the contradictions that exist materially in the United States actually lead to one. There are some astroturfed ideological differences that induce that kind of polarization. I mean, this has been the tradecraft of the CIA around the world. Look at all of Latin America. Even look at the attempted color revolution in Iran recently and the things that happen around the world like this. They go in, they have a media that divides the population, and they fight over things that are insignificant. But a major policy is made behind the scenes. And, you know, the fact that I don't understand what the process would be,
sure.
The democratic process would be in the United States to amend the Constitution. Because I don't understand what democratic institution would conduct it.
Very well. I'm sorry I got to jump in because we're just out of time here. Don DeBar, I do apologize. I'm sorry. We're just out of time. Activist and commentator Don DeBar there, journalist and author. Daniel Lazar, thank you so much for your contribution.
Thank you.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Yacob Itahwe and the team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم رب هب لي حكما وألحقني بالصالحين
And he said, My Lord, grant me authority and join me with the righteous.
Dear listeners, brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us, you already know we have reached the 83rd verse of this chapter. رَبِّ هَبْ لِي حُكْمًا وَأَلْحِقْنِي بِالصَّالِحِينَ Prophet Abraham continues, وَجْعَلْ لِي لِسَانَ صِدْقٍ فِي الْآخِرِينَ وَجْعَلْ لِي مِنْ وَرَثَةِ جَنَّةِ النَّعِيمِ And ordain for me a goodly mention among the posterity and make me of the heirs of the Garden of Bliss. These are how Prophet Abraham supplicates to his Lord. In some Islamic narrations, the Quranic phrase لسان صدق mentioned here has been rendered into the Holy Prophet of Islam sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam and the commander of the faithful Imam Ali alayhi salam. Now, what does Prophet Abraham ask Allah? And he continues his important demands. So he humbly asks Allah to treat with him in a way that his remembrance may remain in minds and his line and program would continue among the later generations. وَجْعَلِّي لِسَانَ صِدْقٍ فِي الْآخِرِينَ So, except for the possible interpretation that we mentioned about لِسَانَ صِدْق, this is a kind of a goodly mention. This is the kind of good remembrance. He wants him, subhanahu wa ta'ala, to make him such an example that others follow him. And he should be the founder of a school by which people can learn the correct way and move on his line. That is why he is asking the Lord, لِسَانَ صِدْق. And elsewhere, the Holy Quran says that Allah accepted the supplication of Abraham, and he says in the Holy Quran about Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, and say, We assigned unto them a high and true renown. وَجَعَلْنَا لَهُمْ لِسَانَ صِدْقٍ عَلِيَّ
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly The Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
أيها الناس وأنتم
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
About this verse, وَجْعَلْ لِي لِسَانَ صِدْقٍ فِي الْآخِرِينَ, and ordain for me a goodly mention among posterity, it is not improbable that this demand contains the same thing that Abraham asked Allah after building the house of Kaaba, when he said, Our Lord, raise among them an apostle of their own to recite unto them your revelations, and to teach them the book and the wisdom, and to purify them. This is the 129th verse of chapter Baqarah. رَبَّنَا وَبَعَثْ فِيهِمْ رَسُولًا مِّنْهُمْ يَتْلُو عَلَيْهِمْ آيَاتِكَ وَيُعَلِّمُهُمُ الْكِتَابَ وَالْحِكْمَةَ وَيُزَكِّيهِمْ. And we know that this demand came into action when Prophet of Islam, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, announced his call, and by this way, the good mention of Abraham, ala nabiyyina wa alihi wa alayhi salam, continued to be among this great nation. Anyway, up to now, we learned what to ask from the Almighty Allah. One of the things that we really need is a goodly mention among the posterity, among the people that are yet to come. So it is really important to take the people to come into account. It is really worth mentioning and worrying about how the people of the next generation will judge about what we did in our time. لِسَانَ صِدْقٍ فِي الْآخِرِينَ. And this is the demand of a very righteous, divine man. They both want to be popular in this world and hereafter as well. لِسَانَ صِدْقٍ فِي الْآخِرِينَ. Because they know they are in need of the remembrance of the people in this life. Because the human beings are not going to be completely dead and the doors between this world and hereafter closed after death. No, they are still in need of good deeds in this world. And one of the good doors that the Almighty Allah has set open for the people after death is that the others do righteous deeds for them and instead of them in this world. And lisan sidq, good remembrance, goodly mention, is one of them. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The Pentagon has admitted that the United States has soldiers on the ground in the Ukraine and far from their embassy, a decision which drastically increases the chances of accidentally sparking an all-out war with Russia. The troops are allegedly only inspecting and doing a proper accounting of U.S. arms deliveries to Ukraine, but many have alleged that their actual role is to provide weapons training and perhaps more. The United States has already provided nearly $20 billion worth of military equipment to Ukraine this year. Both Republican leaders and some progressive Democrats have openly criticized the costly aid, which has only further escalated the conflict. It has already been widely reported that scores of U.S. ex-military personnel and retired officers are helping to lead the war from inside Ukraine. The Pentagon claims the so-called inspectors will not travel to the front lines, but that gives many little comfort.
I think they're acting very recklessly, and they're dragging us to something that could be completely avoided now that you have, you know, Russia saying, hey, we'll use nukes if you don't back off, right? And I think this isn't a war between, you know, Ukraine and the United States. This isn't a war between Ukraine and Russia. It's a war between NATO using Ukraine as a proxy to weaken Russia.
Washington has known for months that their weapons shipments went totally untraced once they entered into Ukraine. Not only does that facilitate Defense Department mismanagement and possible corruption, but the arms could wind up in the hands of far-right militias and be used to destabilize the area for years, as NATO weapons did in the Balkans and then Libya. U.S. weapons have already been found to have been illicitly diverted to Sweden, Denmark, and as far away as the Netherlands.
When you have the United States, when you have the Pentagon saying, hey, we're going to post all these long-range missiles on your border, Ukraine, so that you can reach Moscow in 6 minutes, obviously Russia is going to do something about it. So I think the United States foreign policy right now is essentially pouring billions into Ukraine, pouring like billions into mercenaries, pouring billion into this proxy war in order to weaken Russia.
With the U.S. kicked out of Afghanistan, illegally occupying northeastern Syria, and precariously perched in Iraq, many wonder if Washington and NATO have chosen the Ukraine for their new theater of war. Anti-NATO demonstrations across Europe have been violently repressed in recent weeks. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
A new report by the Afghan Journalistic Center shows that at least 127 journalists and media workers lost their lives during the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. Investigations also show that in more than 90% of those cases, the ones responsible for the deaths were not brought to justice. The Association of Afghan Reporters is demanding the International Criminal Court to take a look into the killings. People are also asking the Taliban to stay true to what it has promised and show support towards Afghan journalists. That includes ending impunity for crimes against this group of workers who are constantly under danger in a war-torn country.
The U.S. started the war on Afghanistan and caused devastation and casualties. It should be held accountable for the death of all civilians, especially journalists, in the past 20 years. The International Criminal Court should investigate the killing cases of Afghan journalists and recognize them as international crimes. The families of slain journalists should be paid compensation. Unfortunately, so far, not a single case has been inspected.
This comes as those 127 martyred journalists have been two honest and dedicated staff, Said Farhad Takaddousi and Habibullah Hussainzadeh, who lost their lives on duty in 2011 and 2017. The relatives and colleagues of the two continue to honor their memory.
Two of our colleagues at Press TV were among the victims of U.S. war on Afghanistan. Syed Farhad in 2011 and Habibullah was martyred in 2017, both on duty and in war incidents. They were so close to me and meant a lot for Press TV and the medium community in Afghanistan. Their loss should not be forgotten or ignored. We demand justice and compensation for their families.
The commemoration of martyrs comes as the Afghanistan situation is still tense for journalists. Rights bodies are calling for support and protection by the ruling Taliban and the international community. Due to war and insecurity, Afghanistan has been one of the most dangerous countries for reporters. And there have been journalists like Press TV's martyrs who gave their lives in the line of duty. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Rating agency Moody's has recently changed its ratings outlook on Italy's banking system from stable to negative. Business conditions for Italy's banks are expected to further worsen in the coming 12 to 18 months, especially with regard to the quality of their loans and earnings. The news broke at the heels of a series of downgrades in medium-term growth forecasts by the Bank of Italy, the National Bureau of Statistics, Istat, Employers Association Confindustria, and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development.
We will hold a highly important cabinet meeting on Friday, during which we will discuss new budgetary targets as the government is racing against time to draft the 2023 budget law.
Italy's statistical agency Istat has predicted that the Italian economy will be flat in 2023 after growth of around 3 to 3.5% this year. Moody's forecast was even more cautious, predicting 2.7% growth for this year as a whole and zero growth next year.
The challenges for Italy go well beyond economic growth. Prices have reached record highs lately, with the country's annual inflation rate hitting almost 12% in October and energy costs still out of control. In addition to that, the euro's weakness with respect to the American dollar has significantly eroded the purchasing power of the Italians.
Milk, bread, pasta. All these basic items cost much more now. I'm very worried.
When you go grocery shopping, but also when you buy fuel or are faced with paying exorbitant energy bills, everything seems to be out of control. That said, I am pretty sure that they are not telling us the truth about what's really going on.
On Thursday, Italy's new far-right Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni travelled to Brussels to meet with the leaders of European Union institutions for the first time. In the Belgian capital, Meloni held two meetings with the President of the European Parliament, Roberta Metsola, and EU Commissioner for Economy, Paolo Gentiloni, in which her main ask was reportedly greater joint EU efforts to cope with energy costs. Max Civili, Rome.
An attack on the convoy of ousted Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan wounded him and several of his supporters who were marching towards Islamabad, demanding early elections. Police said that a gunman opened fire at the campaign truck carrying Imran Khan, wounding him slightly. Since his ouster in a parliamentary no-confidence vote in April, Khan has been alleging that his dismissal was a conspiracy engineered by his successor Shahbaz Sharif and the United States. The PTI leadership has directly blamed Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif, Interior Minister Rana Sanaullah, and a high-ranking military official for carrying out the assassination attempt.
We demand that these three men should be removed from their posts. If these people are not removed from their positions, then there will be nationwide protests.
While asking Imran Khan's supporters to stop the blame game, the government has assured every possible support for holding high-profile inquiry into the assassination attempt.
پرزور الفاظ میں مذمت کرتا ہوں.
The incident is very unfortunate and condemnable, but it should not be politicized and speculations on this incident must be avoided.
Political experts believe that the attack on the PTI party chief will trigger further political instability and chaos in the country.
I think in the days to come, the Pakistani political atmosphere will be more charged. It will be more violent. This gun attack on Khan will definitely change Pakistan's political scenario.
The attack on the former Pakistani premier also sparked countrywide protest and international contaminations.
The attack on the former Pakistani prime minister has further fueled the ongoing political tensions. It is highly believed that more confrontations would be witnessed in days to come in the country's political arena. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The United States has entered its last week before the midterm legislative vote, and tensions are starting to escalate. The Republicans appear certain to win the lower House of Representatives and need to win only one of four now neck-and-neck races to also control the upper Senate. Some Democrats have called the polls Republican propaganda, further undermining confidence in their predictions and creating more uncertainty.
I think it should just be positive. It's very hard to decide what is the truth and what isn't. You get the one candidate, and then the next candidate says everything that the first candidate said is wrong on the commercial. We've started muting them.
Perhaps the most telling poll is one which showed that a whopping 79% of Americans believe that the country is out of control. Many say there's no lack of reasons for such a perception. The specter of a divided and thus ineffective federal government, record inflation, a prolonged drug epidemic, regular mass shootings, a likely double-dip recession, fear-mongering about war with Russia over Ukraine or with China over Taiwan, a cultural war over identity politics, and more.
Perception is reality, right? So, when we see the political attacks that have happened on both sides, it kind of gives that impression. I think the media can feed into that at times as well. I think that's a pretty accurate assessment of where we're at, unfortunately.
The recent in-home attack on the husband of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who holds the number three post in the American system, has become embroiled in salacious controversy. Similar to the Hunter Biden laptop affair in the autumn of 2020, the case is dominating the pre-vote headlines and producing partisan allegations of either misinformation or a cover-up. Since 2017, the number of investigated threats against Washington's lawmakers has tripled. Perhaps the biggest problem in the United States hasn't even occurred yet, the near certainty of disputed election results. Some tight Senate races may require runoff votes, meaning the final outcome will likely be controversial for weeks. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The UK government has abandoned plans to create a working definition of Islamophobia in a move which has come under heavy fire from critics. Back in May 2019, the then government headed by Theresa May agreed it would seek to establish an Islamophobia definition to get a firmer grip of this bigotry and division. But following mounting frustration over a lack of progress on the issue, the effort has now been reportedly ditched.
The news is hardly surprising, as May's successor, Boris Johnson, has been faulted many times over for saying Islamophobic things, whilst other Tory ministers have also been accused of being deeply Islamophobic themselves.
Reappointed Communities Secretary Michael Gove has been a long-time critic of so-called political Islam, and condemned attempts to define Islamophobia as a danger for free speech.
Michael Gove, while he was at Policy Exchange, was very much supportive of anything which, as far as he was concerned, outed Islam. He calls it political Islam. But actually, in reality, it's a phobia which these folk have about any kind of Muslim. When you look at and compare it to how they deal with anti-Semitism. And they're so absolutely hell-bent on definitions, on laws, on rooting out, on chasing, hunting down, witch-hunting anybody who even sniffs the idea of something to do with Jewry, or even say the J word, or even to raise the issue of Zionism, for instance, or to criticize Israel. As soon as you do these things, as far as these neoconservatives are concerned, you are enemy number one.
Islamophobia is a serious problem across Britain. Muslims being the most frequently targeted group for religious hate crimes in England and Wales. Defining Islamophobia could provide new powers to combat anti-Muslim hate. But with a string of scandals having exposed anti-Muslim bigotry within the ruling party itself, Conservatives just don't seem willing to risk shooting themselves in the foot on the issue. Robert Carter, London.
In a narrow alley in the Itaewon Entertainment District of Seoul, more than 150 people suffocated and died in the crush of a crowd on a Halloween Saturday evening. 26 of them were foreigners. Five of those were Iranian, the most of any foreign nationals, exchange students in their 20s and 30s. This week, the lives lost in the Itaewon tragedy are being mourned with white chrysanthemums and black ribbons. And as the investigation into what happened begins, tough questions are being asked of the government and of the police about what more could have been done to prevent such a disaster. As video and news of the event has circulated in both mass and social media, frustration at the response of the government and police has swelled.
Our country is not even at war. Whose fault is it for this to happen? Why were they so careless? Where were the police? This tragedy wouldn't have happened if the police had controlled traffic with a little effort. What are you going to do after killing all those young people?
South Korean Prime Minister Han Duck-soo appeared before the foreign press Tuesday. He suggested South Korea was still one of the safest countries in the world and that preparations were inadequate in part because the event was not registered. But he admitted some failures.
The real issue was some deficiencies in our crowd management. That kind of deficiencies in our system should have been corrected long before, but it's a reality that it hasn't been done, and at least we should not pass that away again.
The Itaewon tragedy is South Korea's worst disaster since 2014. When a ferry sank, killing 304 people, most of them students on a field trip. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A group of Iranians, among them war veterans, gathered in front of the German embassy in Tehran to protest against the German government for Berlin's role in the recent riots in Iran. The protesters, including ordinary people and veterans of the 8-year Iraqi-imposed war on Iran in the 1980s, carried placards and chanted slogans against the German government for its record of supporting former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein and its role in the recent unrest in Iran.
A number of my comrades and friends became handicapped and some were martyred in the war because of the enemy's chemical attacks. Documents that have been released revealed that Germany had provided Saddam with raw materials for chemical bombs. Therefore, we are to say that we do not allow Germany to interfere in the internal affairs of our country anymore. We hold Germany responsible for instigating unrest in Iran.
The demonstrators also vented their anger on the German chancellor and foreign minister.
I am taking part in this protest gathering to condemn the German government for its interventionist stance towards Iranian affairs. We know that Germany and other EU member states, by supporting riots and unrest in Iran, are only after their own vested interests, and they do not truly care about Iranian people.
On Monday, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman criticized Germany for its unconstructive initiative to classify the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps as a terrorist organization. Condemning Germany's move as an irresponsible measure, Nasser Kanani said Tehran hopes that the governments of Germany and other governments would take account of the outcome of their unconstructive measures.
Iranian officials believe that repeating such an approach by Germany and other EU member states towards Iran, which is based on miscalculations and misinformation, will once again expose the Union to failure. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
In more than 900 cities nationwide, Iranians from all walks of life took to the streets on Friday, November the 4th, to mark National Students' Day, the anniversary of the U.S. Embassy takeover, which is also called the National Day Against Global Arrogance. In the capital, Tehran, masses gathered in the streets leading to the building that used to be the U.S. Embassy in Iran before the Islamic Revolution. They chanted slogans expressing their anger and frustration with U.S. hostile policies towards the Islamic Republic of Iran.
We have come here to show our support for our leader in the face of enemies of our country, including the U.S.
Our presence today shows the U.S. that the nation is vigilant and we will not bow down to U.S. plots.
Considering the recent riots, it was even more important for me to take part in the rally this year. We have to show to the world that we love Iran and we support the Islamic Republic.
We are here, and it's literally, we are coming onto the streets 43 years. You cannot find any more democratic country than Iran. What's the turnout of elections in Europe, in the West? They're supposed to be like the civilization and democracy, land of democracy. What's the turnout of their election? Look at all these people. These are coming by themselves.
Every year on the 13th day of the Iranian month of Aban, the Iranian nation, particularly students, hold rallies across the country to mark Students' Day. But this year's rallies come amid violent foreign-backed riots in the country, which have claimed the lives of dozens of people and security forces.
What's significant about this year's 13th of Aban, or Students' Day demonstrations, is the fact that the younger generation taking part in masses to send their message to the world, in particular, many young ladies taking part in this year's demonstration.
The U.S. should know that we have chosen to wear our hijab, and no one can force us to take it off.
Our hijab is a symbol of our religion and our faith. Our country is an Islamic country, and this is the way we choose to live.
In a statement, the demonstrators pledged allegiance to the Islamic Republic and the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei. They also called on authorities to address people's legitimate demands and also draw a line between peaceful protesters and rioters. Kisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
In the limelight.
Scientists are working on fast-acting nasal sprays to block coronavirus infections, but formulating the sprays is a challenge. Stay with us for an exclusive article in this regard written by the publication Nature. Here's the details. During the throes of the COVID-19 pandemic, Anne Moscona didn't feel safe going to a restaurant or catching a flight, and she wished she could feel confident that she could see her immunocompromised relatives without inadvertently spreading the novel coronavirus to them. All this made her work personal. For the last decade, Moscona, a molecular virologist, had been hunting for compounds that could stop viruses in their tracks before the pathogens infect even a single cell in a person's body. Now Moscona at Columbia University in New York City and her colleagues had homed in on a compound that might foil SARS-CoV-2 even better. It simply sprayed up the nose. No needle. The spritz developed by Moscona.